And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, where we have a brand new debut guest live sitting in studio. Self-described dweeb in a suit. Former Harvard professor. Won't hold that against you.
Mm.
Former San Antonio Spurs executive. I will hold that against you. And author of the brand new book, Sprawl Ball, a visual tour of the new era of the NBA. My former Grantland.com colleague, among other things, Kurt Goldsberry. How are you?
I am great. It's glad to be here. I can't believe I've not been here before. Zach, kind of responsible for helping me get to Grantland. I don't know if we're allowed to tell that story.
You can tell whatever story you want.
If you like shot charts, you owe a lot to Zach Lowe for helping me find Grantland and helping Grantland find me. So
no,
thank you, Zach.
I think it's the latter, Grantland finding you. You would have been, you were found already. But
the 2012 Sloan Conference, when you were in Sports Illustrated, you wrote some very kind words about my dweeby research paper about, hey, let's make some shot charts, people.
And now it's a book called Sprawl Ball, which we're going to talk about later.
Anyway.
As you're now on a whirlwind book tour, you got Kimmel tonight.
And then I'm doing Oprah.
Francesa.
I couldn't get on Mike Francesa. I listened to him all day yesterday driving from Bristol. What a guy, huh?
Apparently he said some – did he say some stuff? Apparently he said some stuff that's not good, right? Didn't he say some stuff?
Yesterday?
I don't know. I thought he's in the news.
He was mad about the New York Giants when I was listening.
Whenever I see things on Twitter, I just assume that it's all bad. Like, okay, I see Mike Francesa's like visage on Twitter like multiple times. Like he did something bad. Let's talk briefly about the playoffs and then we will talk about your book because the playoffs are going on. Pick a game from last night, whatever game you want. There were only two. Pick one you thought was interesting. Let's dig into one of these two series. We had our first game two of the second round between the Raptors and the Sixers, and that was just a freaking slugfest. And then we had something that was not a slugfest between the Blazers and the Nuggets. What do you got?
Well, the one game was very defensive and one game was very offensive oriented. I think the first thing I noticed in the early game was, there's some defense being played right now. And I thought that, the Sixers did exactly what they needed to do, Zach, to bounce back from what happened in game one. And they did what an underdog should do, is split those first two games on the road. And credit to Brett Brown, credit to Joel Embiid, who had a great game despite only making two field goals.
The pass to Jimmy Butler with about 2.5 minutes left for a three that I think put them up five or something. And then was a sensational pass because Joel Embiid is the biggest human on the floor and you could not see him. He was doubled. He was swarmed and blanketed. And I didn't think he was going to make it. I thought he was going to fall over.
Right.
And lose the ball. And he found a way to get it to Jimmy Butler. By the way, underrated stat from this game, 10 three-point attempts for Jimmy Butler.
First time in a long time, if ever, in his playoff career. I have a good stat from that Embiid pass. The Sixers shot 5 of 7. Beyond the arc off of Embiid's passes.
That's the bellwether for Joel to me. And it didn't really pass the test last night because he had 6 turnovers and 5 assists. If his assist to turnover ratio were closer to 2-to-1 than 1-to-1, he would be a different kind of player. But he's already sensational. But and the drive to the basket, the pick and pop drive, stop and not and one, just lay right-handed layup. That was the, considering the stakes, that was the best play of his career.
And that was the second field goal of the game. I mean, he'd be shut out. And he comes in, and, he makes the biggest offensive play of the game, I thought, for Philly. And then on the other end of the court, people are going to look at Embiid's line and be like, he only had two buckets. And that's weird, and it is. But he defended Siakam, too, last night and slowed down that man.
Yeah, that was the adjustment everyone was trying to see what their match – I mean, everyone was saying, well, Simmons should guard Kawhi. Brett had started doing that by halftime of game one. I'm frankly was a little surprised by how badly Kawhi ate Jimmy Butler's lunch in the first half of game. I don't know why. I've started saying eat someone's lunch a lot lately. I don't know if I'm hungry for lunch all the time. Is that a schoolyard thing? Like you steal someone's
lunch money?
You take their money.
But it's the next level, Zach.
It's just to eat their lunch.
Just reach over. The kid who brings their lunch, that's how you get them. You eat it.
You just reach over and grab somebody's sandwich, take a bite out of it, and hand it back to them. That's the best move, is hand it back to them.
And Kawhi took Jimmy Butler's peanut butter and jelly, and he ripped it in half with his teeth and then threw the rest on the ground.
My friend Tim Joseph, who acquired his PhD at Harvard University.
Safety school.
We were teachers together at a high school in New Jersey in 1999, 2000, 2001. He t- t- tells a story. I'm gonna hopefully get this right. It's his proudest moment as a teacher, which I think shows you his high school teaching priorities. Someone brought a bagel into his class, and it was an explicit rule at the school. You cannot bring food into a classroom. And this was someone, I think, who was like one of those little irritant students already. It wasn't like a good, it was like the Marcus Cousins breaking a rule.
Yeah.
And instead of saying anything to the student, he just went over to the desk, picked up the bagel, took one bite out of it, and threw it in the trash.
Power move.
It's a great move.
You have to do that.
Tim Joseph.
Shout out to Tim Joseph.
So that adjustment worked. And it's not, they have done this with Embiid a lot this year. If there's a non-center if there's another big man on the floor, the power forward who's a non-shooter, they'll put Embiid there and try to hide him. I thought it worked. They forced a lot of mid-range jump shots and floaters from Pascal that just didn't go in. They couldn't quite get to Mark posting up Tobias Harris, which is the other side. They got to it some. I would suspect they'll get to it more because it looked good when they kind of got a handle on it. What else should we look for in terms of – because they're going to repeat that matchup setup now because it worked.
Yeah, I don't have the stats in front of me, but I think the Philly bench outplaying the Toronto bench was shocking to me statistically. But the stat I wanted to go back to is Embiid was Siakam's primary defender on 16 of his 25 shots in game two. And he wasn't his primary defender on any shots in game one. And when he was Siakam's defender, Siakam was just 3 for 10. And I think the glaring stat for me coming out of game one, Zach, was that 28 of 38 between Kawhi and Pascal.
Woo.
And so I think if you can slow that down, anything, if you want to get Gasol in the post, I think the Sixers will live with that. Hey, can Marc Gasol beat us from the post in a playoff game? Let's see that.
So. I think he can beat Tobias Harris in the post.
I think he could.
And look, they'll make it hard with some shading and some late double teaming and all the things that teams do when they're willingly inviting a post up. But I just think Mark is a good enough passer. I mean, this is the story of the game is Marc Gasol 1 for 6, Danny Green 1 for 8, Serge Ibaka 1 for 5. You know, those guys more than Pascal. I also think they only kind of scratch the surface of Siakam as pick and roll ball handler. I think is an interesting way to make Embiid guard a little bit more. Use Lowry as the screener. I don't think they did a good enough job hunting J.J. Redick, who was guarding Danny Green most of the time. They really hurt them in game one. The timing of like the Kawhi-Danny Green pick and rolls they tried, just kind of didn't work. And part of that, I thought Simmons had a fantastic defensive game on Kawhi, all things considered. Yeah. 13, it's amazing how good Kawhi has been. We're talking about Kawhi. I'm sorry, this is a sore spot for you.
Well, you know, we should probably leave that one alone.
We should lean away from that one.
You know, I got some friends listening down in the San Antonio area. Shout out to them.
Simmons, I thought, just did a good job kind of being big. Like, he's one of those guys, like, if you go under a screen on a guy you shouldn't go under on, like Kawhi, he's big enough to get back into the play and interfere with the shot.
You know, Simmons has the potential to be a great defender. I mean, he has the point guard instincts, which helps you on defense. And as he grows into the league, he'll know the other team's calls and their tendencies. And I think his body's going to do most of the work. I couldn't believe that we're talking here sitting about 23 combined points from Ennis and Greg
Moose.
Moose. Shout out to
Moose Crossing.
Talk about midseason acquisitions. You know, Gasol, obviously a great one. But Greg Monroe, that was a huge performance for them.
You know what Greg Monroe did, by the way? That Joel Embiid does not do enough. He rolled to the basket. And they picked on Marcus. I mean, Mark's a very good defensive player, but if he has a weak spot, it's you got to make him guard in space on the pick and roll. They have clearly decided we are going to do that. We're going to do it with Jimmy and Tobias as our ball handlers, which creates an interesting puzzle piece of like, where are we going to put Ben Simmons when all this is happening? We can talk about that. But Greg Monroe rolled hard. Joel Embiid never rolls. He's like DeMarcus Cousins. He loves to pop out and sit there at the 3-point line and unleash his little pump fake, which people fall for some reason. It's just a little thing I've noticed. And when Ben Simmons is the only other non-shooter on the floor, you can move him around in different ways. You can move him from one side of the paint to the other into the weak, the strong side dunker spot. So it's an awkward help assignment. Like Joel could get some roll buckets that he just doesn't go for.
He's a monster. Yeah. There's nothing more annoying in basketball. We'll get to some things that are very
annoying. You're very annoyed by the state of the NBA.
Well, you know, we'll get to that. But I like when my centers are rolling, to your point. Like Boogie, I don't want Boogie shooting 6 threes a night. I want that guy going and catching lobs. And I want, Joel Embiid, you think he could roll the hoop? That'd be nice. I think that Greg Monroe does play that sort of old school biggish game, not always to great effect, but last night was 4 for 7, and gave them 10 points off of a very maligned bench, and they outscored, as you already alluded to, the Raptors underperformed. Their second unit gave them 5 points, Zach?
Well, and they've got Ibaka 13 minutes minus 12. I thought one of the obvious issues that Toronto is going to face in this series is the way Philadelphia staggers its minutes in such an extreme, rigid way versus the way Toronto is sort of more traditional. There were going to be a lot of minutes where Serge Ibaka was guarding Joel Embiid, and it was very obvious that those minutes were going to go badly for Serge Ibaka. They have. In 26 such minutes over two games, the Sixers are plus 28. And Joel has not even really been able to get into the post that much against Serge. They just haven't been able to find him enough openings, and Toronto's defense has done a nice job helping off the non-shooters. Like, when you have Bolden and Simmons out there with Joel Embiid, it's just going to be hard to post him up because there's just no space anywhere down there. The help is too easy. But even then, plus 28 in 26 minutes.
Yeah, that's not good. And I think, you know, that bench deserves some sort of negative attention, whether it's Serge or Norman Powell was also very ineffective last night. But yeah, how do these rotations, like you're saying, that's fascinating. How do you deal with the staggering of this, you know, really good top five lineup, the creative staggering that Brown does? How can Nick Nurse sort of counter that with a more conventional rotation?
Yeah, that I think you will see more close minutes matching in the next game. And you know, if I'm a Raptors fan, I'm not unnerved by last night. Last night was a weird, ugly, gritty physical play. It just was a strange game. I couldn't get a feel for the game. I couldn't get a feel for where it was going. I still think Toronto's better and that they're going to win the series. For some reason, that game left me with a strange feeling of like, I'm kind of not, you know, some game twos you see, okay, team B figured something out from game one. I think Philly's figured some stuff out. Those adjustments worked, but there was nothing that, it doesn't just seem untenable. It doesn't seem like they've figured out the series to me. I still think Toronto's better.
No, Toronto's a great team. They're deep. As you already pointed out, some guys had terrible shooting nights. One of the stats that sticks out for me, if this Embiid on Siakam thing can work, Zach, through two games, Siakam and Kawhi are accounting for 66% of the Raptors' points.
That's a lot of points.
That's a lot of points for two guys. And this isn't the same Raptors. That's another point, right? These we wouldn't be saying that obviously last year. So they're depending on players that we haven't seen them depend on. But if you can slow Siakam down with that point in mind with this matchup, somebody else has to do something.
Well, they also took half their shots.
Yeah.
Literally last night they took half the shots. Like Danny Green missed good shots, including that potential game tying look where Kyle Lowry fell down and then some stuff happened and then all of a sudden Danny Green had the ball.
Yeah, Danny's had a fantastic year. I love Danny Green. Kyle missed some shots early. He hit a couple big shots.
Everyone's hating on Kyle today.
He had 20 points.
Yeah, 25 and 5. Like, I realize there, every playoff game, there are five places in my notes where it says Kyle Lowry passes up an open three. Two out of the five times it works out because he's so smart that an extra pass and a cut and this and that creates something. Two out of five times you're like, well, that was dumb,
right?
And it didn't work out. And then one out of five times, maybe some other crazy stuff happens. Marcus Gasol used to score. Like, I understand Marcus Gasol is a very persnickety guy. He wants to pass. He has a very, you know, he has a very, a very core belief system about how the game should look. And this is something you got to make more than one basket. Like, there was a time where you scored 20 points a game in the playoffs. Like, just make more than one basket. Anyway. Good for the Sixers, a good win. And by the way, adjustments. I don't want to talk too much about Milwaukee-Boston because by the time this posts, it'll be only a few hours before tip. This is this the biggest game of Mike Budenholzer's career as a head coach?
I can't think of a bigger one off the top of my head.
Because the
big...
Hawks games were kind of doomed against Cleveland. Like, it was very clearly, like, the Hawks-Cavs conference finals, it was very clear early on the Hawks were doomed.
Right. And from game one went a thousand ways right for the Celtics and a thousand ways wrong for the Bucks. Like, the game plan that Stevens brought was exactly right. I mean, the Horford matchup on Giannis worked. The shooting worked on the other side. Kyrie's creating shots for his teammates. They got a lot of open looks. Jaylen Brown's doing everything right. Budenholzer has to come back. Giannis has to get better looks. And some of that has to come from the game plan. And they have to do a better job on the defensive end. That was one of their worst defensive games. I forget what the final score was. It was like 120. What did Boston end up with in that game?
112-90.
Yeah, that's a lot of points for the Bucks giving up this year. They also didn't get a lot from some of their role players in game one.
I just want to say, I don't want to belabor this series because we're going to sit here and talk about X's and O's, and there are going to be different X's and O's to talk about in like 10 hours. I just don't want to hear about how we don't have to adjust and everything's fine. Like, this is the great unknown about Bud as a coach, and I am a Bud acolyte. I voted him coach of the year twice now. I think Bud is a great, great coach. Playoff adjustments is the great unknown about Bud. And if I'm a Bucks fan, the worst possible thing to hear after game one was, hey, we got to come play harder. We didn't really play hard enough. You know, we got to be more ourselves. We don't have to adjust. You know, you can adjust. You're allowed. Mm-hmm. Like, you're allowed to play. You're allowed to play a playoff. How about step one? Play a playoff rotation. Like, play your best players more than 35 minutes a game.
Dude.
Playoff rotation. Giannis played 17 minutes in the first half, and I wrote in my notes, 17 yep. minutes is not enough. This is a big, big game. You win game one at home. You're up 1-0. Boston now has to beat you 4 out of 6 without home court advantage. You have a massive advantage already just by winning game
one. No, that's a great point. I looked at the minutes, too, as well. And if you look at what Golden State's doing with minutes, they're leaving it all out there already.
They got serious right away.
Right. And so I think that's interesting. Do you think that Giannis, Middleton, Lopez, Bledsoe will each get 5-6 more minutes tonight? Because it looks like, looking at this box score, there's a lot more
this
minutes.
This is a game where if Giannis has to play 44 minutes, Giannis plays 44 minutes.
Right.
Sterling Brown doesn't play 44 minutes or doesn't play, you know, what did he play, 22?
Yeah, you want to be the MVP?
Ilyasova, no, not 19 minutes out of you. Pat Connaughton, not 24 minutes out
right.
of you.
That's the other end of this. It's like, look at these big minute numbers for George.
And
I
had all these Bucks fans tell me, oh, you're not watching Sterling Brown play. If you think Kyrie Irving can hide a little bit on Sterling Brown, you're not watching Sterling Brown play. First of all, I've watched every playoff game, so I'm watching Sterling Brown play.
Yeah.
Second of all, you don't think the Celtics coaches are like, oh man, it is so nice to have Sterling Brown playing instead of Malcolm Brogdon.
Oh,
like,
Brogdon.
If we need to hide Kyrie a little bit, that's a matchup we feel comfortable. You don't think that meeting happened? Because I got news for you. That meeting happened. Sterling Brown was 1 of 7, minus 18 in game one. Malcolm Brogdon has a skill set that no one on the Bucks really has in terms of three-point shooting and the ability to really decisively drive closeouts.
Dude, and that's what Jalen said right after the game, to his credit. He's like, when Horford stifles a Giannis drive and the ball goes, if it finds Sterling Brown, that's a very different predicament than if it finds Brogdon. Because Brogdon can make a play. And Jalen said there's not a lot of guys out on the edge right now for Milwaukee who can pass, dribble, and shoot and create a play off of that kick out if they get closed out. And I think that's exactly what's going to happen. So, yeah, Sterling Brown is a big... big sort of drop.
Sterling Brown's solid. Solid. All I said in my preview was the Celtics, if they so choose, can buy Kyrie Irving some. If the Bucks
right.
start to play the like Hunt Steph Curry offense with Kyrie, which I did not think they did enough of in game one, not nearly enough, find him and have his guy screen for Giannis like 40 times.
I know. Why not?
And they, if that happens, then, well, okay, you do what. You do what the Sixers are doing with J.J. Redick. You put him on the least threatening guy and say, if you're going to do that, you're going to do it with Danny Green and not Kyle Lowry. You're going to do it with Sterling Brown and not Eric Bledsoe. Anyway, enough Bucks. This is a big night, though.
Huge.
And by the way, in Boston wore their black uniforms. I think, and they did it in game one of the first round, too. I think they should start every game they wear those down 5-0.
You hate them. I hate them. The green, this is something we definitely agree on. Those green uniforms are the best uniforms in the league, and they messed them up.
No black uniforms.
Yeah.
If the Bucks are wearing green, you wear white.
Right.
That's it.
You have two of the best.
Or you
kits
wear the white ones
with
the new gold trim they had this year. Which
that was okay. Don't mess with it, man.
People, it's that time of year again. The playoffs, basketball's home stretch. This is where all the hard work pays off when we see who's tough enough to be crowned the champion of the NBA. It's where players are more driven than ever to go further, faster, and longer. And that's what drives Goodyear to make tires that do the very same thing. Goodyear knows that performance is everything, whether it's on the road or on the basketball court. So when it comes to choosing tires, let Goodyear.com help you choose what's best. Goodyear, more driven. Let's talk about Nuggets. Blazers, a 121-113 win, I believe, for your fight in Denver Nuggets. And I just want to say, you forget, it's amazing how there's just so much happening in the NBA that you forget things. You forget people. So I sit down to watch the first quarter of this game, and I'm taking notes. Oh, Jamal Murray, no going on. And then like 6 minutes into the game, it dawns on me, how awesome would it be if Jusuf Nurkić were healthy?
On
every level.
Well, first of all, yeah, no love lost, I think,
yeah.
Number one.
That's yes. What I'm not even talking about matchups. I'm just saying the level of trash talk and bitterness, and it would have been really fun.
Yeah, and it's too bad, and I think it's going to affect this series. If we saw anything in game one, it was the lack of defense from Portland Bigs, able to slow down Jokic at all. 37-9-6 for the Joker. And, you know, the general basketball community is getting a nice introduction to this Nuggets team right now. And they could get all the way to the Western Conference Finals, Zach.
They could. The brackets broke. They broke the brackets, right? The brackets didn't break right for them. They broke the brackets. Nikola Jokic in the playoffs so far, 25 points, 12 rebounds, 9 assists per game on 50% shooting, 37% from deep, 55% from two. Where are my Nikola Jokic skeptics at?
Dude.
Where are they at? He's not for real. He's going to fail in the playoffs. What are y'all doing now?
And he can do everything. The thing is, and I took this from Stats and Info this morning, but Jokic, by play type, his points this postseason, he has 40 points on cuts, 38 on catch and shoot, 26 off post up, 24 on drives, and 20 on putbacks. The guy is diverse. He is not a one-trick pony. And he's a treat to watch, let alone his passing. And so here's the crazy thing about Jokic. He is the assister on the top two assister to shooter duos in the playoffs so far.
So that's Murray and Harris?
And Gary Harris. Very good, Zach. Jokic to Harris is number one. Jokic to Murray is second. So this guy is getting more touches than anybody in the playoffs. Think about that. The center for the Denver Nuggets is getting more touches per game than Harden, than Lillard, than anybody else. He is the quarterback of one of the best offenses in the NBA, in a team that has emerged this year and is threatening to go all the way to the semifinals of the NBA.
He is shooting. So this is the Murray Jokic pick and roll after a slow start has started to get, no pun intended, rolling. And really destroyed the Blazers last night. And it was actually kind of funny to see these two teams coming off one long series, one not so long, but against, in some ways, very different personnel. So like Murray, Jokic, well, Portland starts to defend that the same way. Just drop Kanter back, mm-hmm. go over the screen. And all of a sudden, it's like, oh, this point guard can hit a floater. The other point guard we just played couldn't hit anything. And this center, Jokic's floater has become like automatic in the playoffs.
Is there anybody with a prettier arc on a shot right now than Jokic? He's so high. Maybe Steph.
He's shooting 45% on short mid-range shots in the playoffs and 55% on a little bit longer mid-range shots, according to Cleaning the Glass, which is like crazy good. And you saw it last night. Like, they broke the Portland defense pretty fast.
One of the early shots, Myers Leonard was like 4 feet off of Jokic at the free throw line. And Jokic is like, okay. It's just like Kevin Garnett in, you know, Boston era. It's like, oh, this is a free shot. I'm taking this, and he's great at it.
Yeah, and I tweeted during the game his three-pointer is going to be something of a bellwether, but I think it's actually, as the game went on, I was like, it's actually that just that he's making this floater and this mid-ranger so consistently, you could see them begin to change their defense. So they start flashing a third guy at him when he catches the ball.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, Gary Harris's defender is CJ McCollum is halfway from Gary Harris to Jokic. Jokic is going to see that right away. Bam, Gary Harris gets a.
Did you tweet out the passport picture?
I did. Yeah. Well, someone else tweeted it out and I retweeted it.
Yeah, I saw it too. Incredible.
Someone tweeted in response, he looks like the fat first baseman who leads Little League in home runs. And I was like, yeah, that is exactly what he looks like.
That is, that's very good.
Yeah.
He also looks exactly like that kid, which may not be surprising, but it's now funny now that I'm watching this game and I watch him. So he has this weird lumbering body motion, you know, he's kind of this different guy. I love him. There's nobody like him. If you like basketball, you like the sport because weird guys can thrive in weird ways. And this is a player, we have never seen somebody like this. Blending all these skills together. So, you know, I hope the series goes deep, and I'm just having fun watching Jokic, even though he beat my beloved Spurs in the first round.
He did. They did. And I just, again, you could see them kind of, like, at the end of the game, they put Aminu on him and Harkless on Jamal Murray so they could switch that. I don't know that that's going to be a solution. It sounds good. That scares me about unlocking his post game to that degree.
He's a monster. And speaking of those two dudes, on offense, they didn't give them anything. They combined to take 1-3, Harkless and Aminu. That tells me that they're not getting the shots they think they're going to get. And Denver's defense was actually really good in that San Antonio series in terms of forcing hard shots. Tell me why I'm wrong, Zach. Denver's going to win the series. Tell me why I'm wrong.
I don't necessarily think you're wrong. Yeah. To me, this was a Portland in six or Denver in seven kind of series. I actually thought Portland's offense, this is not an uncomfortable matchup for Portland. Like, they just played a team that is going to defend their pick and roll the same way as the Nuggets are. Send two to the ball.
Yeah.
They know exactly what plays to run. They know how to counter it. Cantor knows what kind of plays he has to make. He's not that great at it, but he knows what to do. I thought Dame and CJ both came prepared to face that kind of defense. They know various counters. The team knows 5-6 different sort of core sets they run in response to that kind of blitzing, trapping, whatever defense. So I think Portland, but to your point, Portland often comes down to like how many threes do Aminu and Harkless hit? And if the answer is like zero, they usually lose. And if the answer is five, they usually win.
Right.
Speaking of which, how many baskets do you think Evan Turner has in the whole playoffs?
Oof. Evan Turner over. I can't remember, man.
They've played six playoff games.
I don't know. You're making me think it's shockingly low. So should I say six?
You'd be way over.
No way.
One. Evan Turner is 1 for 12.
The villain.
In the playoffs.
Come on, Evan. Yeah, they're not getting enough. Like, how much can Dame do? Sure, Dame's going to score 39 and 6. Great. How are you getting the other 70 points? How are you going to get up
and
to...
And Cantor gave you 26.
Cantor...
With a bum shoulder.
Dude, and he had that dunk early in the game where it was like, and oh my God. And he like...
Didn't he also hurt his hand once punching a chair? These self-inflicted...
But he didn't need to dunk the ball that hard. I'm like, dude, your shoulder's messed up.
You know what, though? If I could dunk, I would dunk as hard as I could every single time.
Even if you're, what is this, his orbital bone or something? Even if you have a banged up AC joint or whatever we're talking about with him? I felt so bad for him, but he was tough. You could tell him as he walked back to the bench. He's like,
You know where you could see it more than anything else? Is Jokic beat him to a couple offensive rebounds where they basically started in equal position going towards the glass, or even Cantor maybe had a little bit of inside position, and they bumped. And, like, you don't bump Enes Kanter. Like, Enes Kanter bumps you.
Right.
And they bumped, and Enes Kanter gave. And Jokic just went in there. I think he got two putbacks, just got the ball and laid it up. And
well, that's...
That looked to me like a guy who was worried that his body can't take that kind of contact.
Well, and that could be a series ender because the second chance points for Denver are such a weapon. They killed the Spurs with that. If Kanter can't bang around with Jokic and he can get a few extra putbacks a night because of it, it's just another thing. That Nurkic injury, bringing this full circle, Zach, it's too bad Nurkic isn't out there because he is a banger. And to watch those guys go head-to-head, they have a little bit of a grudge, and that might be an understatement. It's too bad we're not getting that.
And it just not to pick on Evan Turner, who I like, but, I you know, Terry Stotts went with the full bench mob to start the second quarter, and I believe they lost those minutes. I don't have it in front of me right now. And then he kept Lillard on the floor, I think, to start the fourth quarter, but went small with Evan at the power forward. And both of those things thought, like, I think they might have to keep one of the guards on the floor all the time, which they used to do and stopped doing this year, and kind of got closer to doing that in the first round, and eventually I think did it when the chips were really down. Last night they went all the way back the other way, brought them back together in the second quarter after a long rest. And then I just think the small ball, it's just, I just feel like keep one of Aminu and Turner out there for that lineup, because that was when Millsap torched Evan Turner like four times in a row in the post, because Denver very smartly is keeping one of Millsap or Jokic on the floor the whole game as sort of the stabilizer. I think that's been a nice adjustment by Mike Malone.
Yeah, he's been good in the playoffs. I thought they did not look like they belonged in the playoffs in the first game against the Spurs. And at some point around halftime of game two, there was adjustments. Jamal Murray came back to life. They have one or two more guys that I would trust in big moments than Portland right now. You could argue that Dame is the biggest big shot maker, in the series, and I wouldn't argue with you. But the combination of Jokic and Millsap and Murray, is pretty good. It'll be interesting. I don't know if Denver will be able to win in Portland. If I'm Portland, I'm eager to get home. And challenge that team to play in that environment. Denver deserves a lot of credit for sort of saving their season with a huge Game 4 win in San Antonio.
That was an underrated win.
Huge.
And when they went back to San Antonio and got blown out in Game 6, I feel like they kind of lost a little bit of credit for that win. That's a big, big win. I don't care if you're the two seed. I don't care if you're the two seed, because no one gave them the respect of a typical two seed. So you can't now say, well, they're the two seed. They should do. When you go down 2-1 to the Spurs.
Right.
In very dispiriting fashion. Game 3 was a bad game. They looked mentally broken again because Barton and Murray looked mentally broken by the collective bargaining agreement every 5 games. They must look mentally broken. To go into Game 4 and win that game was really, really impressive.
One of the biggest wins. Like you said, this was a big game for Bud. Right?
It's a big Bud game.
Yeah, and that was a big win for Mike Malone. Saved their season, right? And, you know, San Antonio, not an easy playoff environment to go win in. Either is Portland. Let's see if they can win one in Portland.
Maybe you're just going to – we could, if this microphone could turn off, I would turn it off right now. So I'm going to turn it off. Maybe if you were still with the Spurs, they would have fouled at the end of Game 7. That is the most – again, your mic is off.
Redacted.
You're off.
Redacted.
That is the most inexplicable – I don't know that I've – that was like the Pelicans without had one like that against Phoenix, I think, at the end of the season where like 9,000 things went wrong. And you just like, are they trying to lose on purpose? Is this like when Joaquin Phoenix was doing some sort of like public art persona? They were yelling at LaMarcus Aldridge to foul. All the players on the floor were yelling at LaMarcus Aldridge to foul. None of them thought to go foul. And then they just gave up.
Shout out to Joaquin Phoenix.
Isn't he the Joker now? Isn't there a new Joker?
Yes, it looks very troubling.
People, this show is sponsored, as it often is, by SeatGeek. The ticket industry hasn't changed that much in a long time. There's a bunch of big companies who have been around forever, but they don't really care about making the experience easier for you, the customer. SeatGeek is there to change all that. It has 50,000, actually more than 50,000 five-star reviews in the App Store, and it's focused on making your experience easy. It pulls in millions of tickets from all over the web. It's one-stop shopping. You don't have to click around to a million sites out of fear that you've missed a really good deal. It rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10. It has an interactive seat map. It has green dots for good deals, red dots for less good deals. It's very simple. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. It is by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. Whenever I have a friend from out of town, I need to buy him a ticket to a game. I go there. They've helped me with Broadway shows, comedy shows, you name it. Everything, they have it. Best of all, my listeners get $10 off their first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do, download the SeatGeek app. Enter promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Bam, $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Remember, that's promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, for $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase.
Do you watch Game of Thrones?
No.
I'm looking for someone to talk Game of Thrones with, because
I'm back in. Grantland might be.
I'm back in. No, I'm back in, but I'm the annoying guy. I watched the first 3.5 seasons, bailed out. Watched the last two and then pieces of some of the ones I missed. So I'm emailing Jason Concepcion questions like, can Bran see the future? This is unclear to me. Please advise.
And he's like, I
don't know what he answered. He humored me. Still don't really understand what Bran is.
No, I'm not your guy, Zach.
You're
I'm
too
sorry.
Mature.
No.
I just want it to be part of a pop cultural moment. I'm so rarely part of a pop cultural moment that I just want to be part of it. I want to be able to read the recaps and talk to the people at the cocktail parties I don't go to anymore about whatever it is that's going on.
Or the other NBA writers that are watching it in their hotel rooms on the
road.
And
you know, because people, there are these moments, there are these things that everyone sort of has these shared experiences, and I don't get to do them anymore, so I want to do that. Unless your shared experience is Portland-Denver game two. If you're really into that, we can share that. I'm excited for that game, by the way. I think that's going to be a good game.
The second round of the playoffs is awesome, by the way. Before we get to my grumpy takes on the NBA, I love the NBA playoffs right now. The second round is beautiful.
One of the reasons, other than the officiating fest going on in Oakland, I am looking forward to game two of Portland-Denver because I feel like the teams are already kind of comfortable playing against each other. Dame and CJ are comfortable. Denver did a nice job attacking their pick and roll. They bring the help over early. It's a very nice aggressive defense. Dame and CJ have seen it all before. Jokic actually underrated smart defender. People hate on Jokic's defense. I think he's better than people think. Right. He's often in the right position. That doesn't mean he can actually do anything while he's in the right position, but he's large. He's a good rebounder. If you watch, like, Portland tried to bait him a little bit by setting these picks for Dame, like, at half court, hoping to bring him up that far. Yeah. So then Dame could just cross him up and it's over. Yeah. And he hung right by the 3-point line. So I'm not taking that bait. You come closer to me, I'll come get you. Right. But I'm staying here. On a few, he was almost a little too cavalier. Like, Dame walked into a couple open threes. They're like, you got to get up. It's Damian Lillard. Like, you got to get up a little higher. That cat and mouse game, I'm interested to watch in game
and
two.
Damian didn't have a great shooting night off the bounce. I think he was 3 of 10 on those off the bounce.
He had a couple of air balls. Yeah. It was a little...
Oh, early. I remember an air ball, yeah.
That's going to be... I also like the Lillard, McCollum, Seth Curry 3-guard look. I think it's a little more playable for Portland in this series than it has been in previous series. Part of that is I just don't want to watch a lot of Rodney Hood.
He had a great game, didn't he?
I know. Even in a great game, I'm like, there's just a lot of Rodney Hood happening right now.
Shout out.
Like, we're isolated. He had 17 on 10 shots. I can't complain. I was just like, we're running our offense to Rodney Hood in a playoff game? Like, why are there any minutes where that's a thing?
Yeah, I'm not a big Rodney Hood guy, but he had a great game last night. And,
he did.
It'll be interesting. I hope we get some great moments. The cool thing about this series is, like, these are two organizations that haven't been there. The players were not that familiar with in big moments, aside from maybe Dame. Jokic just showed up in the playoffs, and I love it, man.
I think Jokic just showed up defensively, too. Now, he's had the Spurs by virtue of not really having a 3-point shooting big man or a pick-and-roll guard that scares you were a very soft landing spot for him defensively. Even so, I thought he was quite good in that series in the post. He's usually in the right position. He moves his feet a little better than people think. He gets his hands on a lot of balls. I thought that was a pretty decent defensive series for him. And I thought he was, all things considered, okay against Portland. Monster playoffs for him so far. Listeners, hiring, I can imagine, is one of those things that can be challenging and time-consuming. There are hundreds of job boards. Do you have to post your ad on every one? How do you know that you're not missing the one job board that has the right person? But there's one place where you can go that makes it simple, fast, and smart, and that place is ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost, the name of this podcast. ZipRecruiter sends your job automatically to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, and they don't even stop there. They have powerful matching technology that scans thousands of resumes and proactively finds people with the right experience and then double proactively invites them to apply to your job. You've done nothing except use ZipRecruiter. Bam, they've found people for you. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers, that's a lot. If you shoot 80% from the foul line, that's pretty good. 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. You pretty much can't do any better than that. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free, zero nothing, at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost. The name of this podcast, LowPost. That's ZipRecruiter.com/LowPost. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Let's talk about your book. Sprawl Ball. Sprawl Ball. I'm getting out my dog-eared.
Zach has, I want to say, 7 or 8 post-its through my book. They're mostly in the back half of the book, which is where we look at the future of the game.
That's what I want to talk about. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, man.
So the book is called Sprawlball, and it has a lot of your trademark shot charts, but with even prettier illustrations. And at least I counted three Charles Barkley fat jokes.
Well, he called my community. He's called us names. He's made fun of our ability to get girls in high school several times. He's come after Daryl too many times. So I had to fire back a little bit here.
I enjoyed there was one about kale that I enjoyed. And it goes through sort of it has emblematic players like Steph and LeBron and how they're and Kevin Love and how their shot selection
James Harden
evolved.
Is relevant for today's news.
He certainly is. He's very relevant. We can talk about that if you want.
Oh yeah.
But your general take, and this is something I remember sitting in a Grantland meeting. You were probably there, preseason meeting. It's got to be 2013, maybe. We're going around pitching our ideas. Things that we'll probably never write, but they sound good in a meeting room. And I said, I think it's time to do a story about, like, are there too many threes? Yep. Are we reaching a point? And the whole room was like, particularly Jacoby. Jacoby was like, yes, write it tomorrow. There are way too many threes. It was like my dad came in the room. And all that's happened since is there have been more threes.
The biggest three upticks, I think three of the biggest four upticks in three-point rate since the league added the three-point line 40 years ago. The three of the four biggest upticks, Zach, have been in the last 3 years after Jacoby said that. So, anybody who thinks this is slowing down is exactly wrong. It's actually speeding up.
It is speeding up. The Rockets are obviously the team that's speeding it up, but the Bucks are right there with them. Then you have a bunch of teams that kind of middling. But your worry is the same worry that I expressed and others expressed at that meeting 6 years ago, which is stylistic homogeneity. Everybody going to play this way? That is your worry, right?
And that's been a traditional worry in the NBA. I mean, the NBA, if you love the NBA as much as I do in 2019, you love a league that has changed its rules in the face of homogeneity before. When the post game got too boring and too dominant for Mike and they widened the lane. When Wilt made it the same again, they widened it again. They added defensive 3 seconds. They've curtailed hand checking. They've added goaltending. They've outlawed zone defense. This is not a league that's been afraid of rule changes for its history. But in the face of what I would say is the greatest aesthetic upheaval in the sports history, Zach, we're suddenly sitting on our hands and watching it change so fast.
So one of the reasons that your entire back section here has post-it notes. Here's a line from Kurt Goldsberry, by the way. Albeit in a new way, the game is now as aesthetically monotonous as it was back when Mikan and Russell clogged up the interior. NBA fan Kurt Goldsberry. So one of the things I found very interesting about the back half in particular was you don't just complain. You lay out remedies.
Right.
How can we fix this? And one of the reasons I really love the remedies were that they extended beyond how can we make life harder for three-point shooters. So you get some of the ones that are sort of more popular suggestions. Move the line back. You have a great section on moving the line back. Where should it be? What would the impact of that be? Who would still be able to shoot from there and who wouldn't? And I don't want to spoil the book. You have a particular distance that you think it should be. And eliminating the corner three, which Jeff Van Gundy has been ranting about on television for years. And a whole subspecies of shooters would be hurt by that. I was almost more interested in the flip side of your rules of how can we help big men and post players specifically?
Right.
And those things are all interact, and we'll talk about that. But you, I for some reason, I don't know that I've heard anyone pitch this in a long time. You pitched shrinking the lane again.
Yeah, why not? Nobody's posting up. I would say it's like a giant chastity belt, but we don't need that anymore because nobody's posting up. Like the days of Wilt and Russell are gone. So why we have this 16-foot wide sort of box to sort of make post up harder when post up are so inefficient right now, and that's the margin why it's disappearing because we're so aware of that. I think the most effective post up player right now is Karl Anthony Towns, and he's barely getting a point per post, and like an average three is like a 1.1 or 1.08 shot. So even if you have the best post player in the league, you'd rather have an average player taking an average three. And I don't think that's right. So one way to do it is, yeah, leave the line there, make the post up efficiency a little bit better, let those guys get those deeper touches, a little shorter half hook, a shorter fade away over the right shoulder, whatever. But yeah, we used to mess with this stuff, all the time. I mean, people don't realize how many times
it's a great point.
It's
a great point in your book because you say, we had in the first X years of the game, from Mike into Wilt, we had all these rule changes that were designed to make the game easier for guards.
Yep.
And to make the game less easy
for bigs.
The behemoths.
Yeah.
Goliath, as Wilt would say. and your point is we just kind of kept doing that. Like there was never any – there's never been much – I mean I think – certainly the league has been open to a lot of rule changes and tweaking the lottery rules. Like, I don't want to sit here and say the league office is closed off to this and if, like, they're discussing a play-in tournament and this and that. But your point of, like, the lines on the court and this idea that we need to slide the game a little bit from the domain of big men to more to the domain of guards, well, it just kept on sliding and yep. It never slid back.
That's exactly right. So I always say the three-point line was the biggest rule change of them all, and it opened up the game. I don't want to take away the three-point line by any means, but it was just another example. And when Mikan, who poetically, as the first superstar in the league, draws the three-point line on the ABA court as a commissioner, he sort of signs the death letter for the way that he played. I mean, it didn't happen overnight. But nobody plays like Mikan anymore. And you can largely attribute that to the three-point line, which he introduced to pro basketball at a high level in the ABA. But, you know, and this is a point that I took from RC and Pop at the Spurs, and they're like, yeah, we've legislated against the big man over and over and over and over again. And in Mikan's language, if you go back when he introduced the three-point line to the ABA, he says it's time to give the smaller man a chance. And leading up to the implementation of the three-point line, there was good reason to do that. I think 18 or 19 of the 20 MVPs before that were centers.
And certainly widening the lane was obviously a necessity because
right.
Mikan and could just camp. At the basket.
Oh, yeah.
And so you throw me the ball.
Great rule change.
Yeah.
But we haven't had a center as an NBA this century.
MVP.
MVP, sorry, yeah. We haven't had an NBA MVP that's a center. And so now I think, revisiting Mikan's language, it's time to give the big men a chance, throw them a bone. And I think, yeah, you can do that a few different ways. You know, making speed and skill really important has been great for the game. But strength and size are really important to the heritage of the game as well. So how can we preserve that without sort of going back to this? People are like, oh, Kirk, you want to go back to those Knicks Heat series? And I don't want to do that. But I think we can be creative. Zach, here's my main thesis. Basketball is at its best when there are five natural position groups and we are creating superstars out of all five of those groups and there's tactical diversity on the court and different teams are winning in different ways. And I love what Jokic is doing for the centers, but in general, centers and power forwards have been sort of marginalized compared to where they were 20 years ago. Meanwhile, the MVP is generally given to guards these days. How could we have an MVP who's a center or a power forward ever again if these things continue to change?
I do think there is still a great degree of, there is still a decent amount of stylistic diversity. You just brought up Denver.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons we all like watching Denver is they just don't look like a lot of teams. And
right.
It's not just their shot selection, which I think is middle of the road. It's just they sort of flit around and inhabit those in-between spaces. You know, Jokic and Murray kind of bob and weave at 15, 18 feet from the basket. Jokic looks for backdoor cutters. Like, they just inhabit. The ball moves from point A to point C to point D and B.
Yeah.
The path is just different.
It's different.
There is no team that plays like the Rockets. They're like the Bucks' path to almost as many threes as the Rockets looks and feels much different than Houston's. But I clearly the game is still gravitating in a big general direction, and framing it as one away from post play is, I think, very astute. And I mean, it's just very obvious. Like, if you move the line back a little bit,
yeah,
and you move the lane, you shrink the lane a little bit, that has, I think, would have sort of a mutually compound effect of not only can the guys post up closer to the basket, the help defenders who have to come to dig in or who help you behind the front, they have to cover more distance because the three-point arc is out faster, and that just makes that helps post players too, and maybe that helps ball movement, inside-out ball movement too. I think those are mutually Does that make any sense? They compound each other almost.
No, and that's where I'm like, as an analyst, it's not my purview to project what this would do to the game. Like, if this were to ever happen, and this conversation should happen in the league office, it should involve coaches, it should involve players, it should involve executives, the graybeards who have seen the game for, you know, 60 years. What would happen if we got rid of the corner three? And I think one of the things we can do as analysts, Zach, that's exciting, is we can evaluate these changes with data and with analytics the same way that we optimize shot selection with data and analytics, to make those projections and make this not a study in unintended consequences, but to engineer the most diverse, most beautiful game possible. And that's really how I end the book is like, let's use analytics to build the most diverse, most interesting sport possible. Not just optimize shot selection within the framework of the sport.
And I think that dovetails with the Rockets officiating thing to do two minutes on this. You boil it all down, all the report that Rachel Nichols and I wrote about yesterday, all the report of Game 7 and 81, this and that, all these missed calls or non-calls and what the math is. Really what the Rockets are talking about is three shot fouls. That's it. The rest of it is noise. They claim to have research that shows that postseason officials are less likely to call three shot fouls. That's it. That's the crux of their argument. And I just don't think they're ever going to have any sympathy for that because they're just playing math ball. It's right. there's an inherent sensibility that they've just sort of – they've taken the math to such an extreme. Well, this shot's worth 3 points. He makes it X amount of times. If we get fouled, it's 2.8 right. PPP. We just end up in a landing spot debate. It's just how far forward can James Harden jump versus how far forward can Draymond Green jump? Okay, on this one – it looks like maybe Draymond jumped a little too far, but on this one, James jumped a little too far. It's like it just sort of they're almost victims of their own modernity. Like they're so forward thinking that they're playing a different sport, and it's foreign to how anyone sees the sport. And so they're just never going to win this argument, right. Even if they're right that experienced officials are less likely to call three shot fouls, and maybe it's because those officials watched a different game 20 years ago. They're never going to win.
Well, if somebody had to game plan against this team 2 years ago for a playoff series, we were worried about 3-point shooting fouls then. In the 2016-17 season, Harden had shattered the record by getting 116 3-point shooting fouls.
After which they changed the rules to take away that sort of like you get wrapped around going on a screen and just barf up a shot. It's
right.
Not a foul.
We're going to have to make a new rule about this landing area or clarify the existing rule to help the officials call it, because like the officials are in a terrible spot. This isn't
terrible
about the officials.
And by the way,
right now
we sit here after the games and do exactly what I just described. Okay, let me slow it down. Okay, where are James's 2 feet when he takes off? Where are they when they land? Okay, let me do the same thing for the defender. Okay, I've now spent 1 minute and 45 seconds watching this.
Right.
I'm going to make a conclusion. They don't get to do that. They just see bodies fall over.
The expression that keeps coming back into my head is the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. And like, yes, the Rockets have a point on the letter of the law.
Only that one thing. The rest of what they're doing, I just don't care.
Right.
If you can prove to me that three shot fouls are not being called as often in the playoffs, I don't necessarily, care or agree or, it's interesting. If you can prove that to me, that's materially interesting. Just that. I don't want to hear any whining about anything else. I don't want to hear any whining about, you know, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson's uncalled traveling and Steph Curry bumped Gordon out. That happens. That's all going to even out. The three-shot foul thing is, like, mildly interesting.
Well,
to
let
me
argue with that, because in 2017, if you remember our pick-and-roll defense, it was the hands-up strategy.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, so they didn't get those calls. They were averaging 9 points, or they got three a game in the Thunder series in the first round in 2017. Against us, they got one the whole series, in part because we had this crazy hands-up defense.
Yeah.
And so statistically, if you look at our series with them, you would see, oh, there's no the refs aren't calling those fouls. But it's also because Patty Mills is going over every screen with his hands up above his head, trying not to get anywhere near the breadbasket.
And I think Patty Mills had seen a pick and roll before. So he knows how to get around a screen. People just haven't seen this step back three before.
Right.
And so, like, I know one Western Conference team, one of their coaches told me, maybe in March or something, like, our solution as a team has been, we're just not going to take a step forward. We're going to put our arms up as big as we can, and we are telling our people, do not step forward, even though that is antithetical to everything you've ever learned about basketball. Do not step forward because you're going to foul him. You see Looney is kind of trying to go sideways, like close out sideways and miss his body, but sort of bother his line of sight maybe. Nobody really knows what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But like the pick and roll, at least like hands up going around a screen, that makes sense to me as a basketball player.
Yeah. So the step back's revolutionary. And I want to say, I give credit to the Rockets for most of their innovations are brilliant. And they've found these margins, the money ball team of the NBA, and they've exploited them all the way to the top of the Western Conference. Most of those changes are within the spirit of the game. And I just wonder if like some of the backlash has to do with just how overtly cynical these plays are. Okay. Trying to exploit a rule that was designed to protect shooters like Kobe Bryant or Kawhi Leonard from these very dangerous, malicious plays, trying to exploit that because there's an analytical advantage to be had. That's really cynical, man. And I don't like it. And it, but to Houston's credit, that's the landscape, the economic landscape the league has created with these very punitive fouls for 3-point shooting. And so if the league is serious about doing it, not only do they have to clarify what that landing area rule is, Zach, I think they have to sort of revisit, disincentivizing these flopping behaviors, these cynical behaviors as soccer has done. And you get a yellow card, in soccer if you are shown to be flopping and trying to draw.
But they're not
a ball
even flops. Like some of the ones that Clay got
him
with in game one were fouls. Some of them he's jackknifing his legs. And I feel like they paid a penalty for that because you fall over, you're out, you get an offensive rebound, you're out of the play, you're on the ground.
But just, that's a very good point. But just like they did with the rip through, okay? The rip through used to be a shooting foul. And I was like, okay, then I just rip through every time somebody's foolish enough to put their hand up, right? And I go to the line. So now that's a side out of bounds.
Yes.
Right? So changing, the league has a responsibility to create that sort of infrastructure from a legislative point of view to deter that behavior or not sort of incentivize it. Cause right now, analytically, the best way to end a possession in the NBA is to draw a 3-point shooting foul. That's worth 2 points. And is that the league you want to watch?
I remember 2 years ago, January 2017, maybe December 2016, I think January 2017, maybe January 2018, whatever. It doesn't matter. The league was very clearly on pace to set its points per possession record. And I was in Toronto talking to some people at a Raptors game. I can't remember who they were, but it doesn't matter. And people were saying, you know, this is a big topic. You got to write about this. So I started calling around to people, trying to get their ideas of like, why now? Obviously, there's an uptick in 3-point shooting and small ball and all these things that, you know, we know are helping offense. And 4 or 5 people said, you should look at the number of 3-shot fouls because I think it's spiked a lot. And the numbers were like astounding when we looked at it. And you're right, because it's like most of the guys shooting threes are good foul shooters. It is the best, period. It is the best way to end a possession. From a purely math standpoint.
Yeah, 3-point shooting foul for James Harden or Chris Paul is better than a wide open Giannis transition dunk.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's one way to put it. Can we talk about one other cool idea you have in your book? I'm looking at these, even the illustrations.
Oh, shout out to Aaron Dana, the illustrator.
They're beautiful.
Who did work with us at Grantland. He's done a lot of portraits in the book. Zach was just looking at one of Rudy Gobert. Now he's looking at one of Anthony Davis that Aaron
did. Here's your point. I'm looking at Draymond Green grabbing Anthony Davis's jersey with one hand and then wrapping the other arm underneath Anthony Davis's arm and on his chest. And again, one of your other points, which is we've made it impossible to play in the post because guys can play football there.
Yeah, the geography of contact allowances on the basketball court is ridiculous. If you dare put your back to the basket, all of a sudden it's legal for a guy to armbar you. And even the rules that we do have, Zach, to protect those guys in that situation aren't really enforced as centers get smaller and smaller.
You can't put two hands on a guy.
It should be an automatic
whistle.
But
people do it all the time.
And it's not. But if you hit an elbow of Klay Thompson, that's a 3-shot foul. So I think sort of making the contact allowances across the court more consistent, protecting, you know, post players are shooters too. That's what I always say. Okay, does LaMarcus get a landing spot when he goes over his left shoulder with the right-handed hook?
That's a good point.
Does Karl Anthony Towns get a landing spot from the elbow on a high post play? They better, because their ankles are fragile too, and their careers could end
be more fragile.
So you know, it's a dangerous area, but we, I think there's just inconsistency. We, going back to that Mikan point, we've legislated against the big man, but we have sort of made it easier and easier because guards didn't have an exciting role in the league for so long. But now it's like you're saying, we just kept going and kept going. And now these guys are arguably babied relative to some of the bigger players playing in the two-point area, like idiots.
Last thing, because I know you got to go. I thought the coolest idea that has some history in the game was shrinking the lane. I thought that was a very smart idea. It's just something that's not brought up. Like, yeah. It's an obvious idea, but it's not something that's brought up. It's interesting to think about what would happen. The coolest one, 3-second violation for standing in the corner.
You like that? Yeah, why not?
I just think it made me – I sat there on an airplane for 15 minutes just staring into space. The other people around me thought, well, he's like David Putty flying back from Norway just staring at his seat. I was thinking, what would happen if P.J. Tucker just couldn't sit in the corner for 15 seconds? What would happen? I don't know.
Right. He would have to, what do they call it, the 2.9-ing that the bigs have to do. Like, there would have to be some equivalent. But, yeah, these guys have it so easier. Look at all the lines and dashes and boxes that big guys have to do if they dare play interior offense. There's no lines outside the three-point line. Those guys can do whatever they want. The game is, like, so regulated inside the line and so, like, free to do whatever you want. So, yeah, one of the ideas is not just to get rid of the corner three, but if we keep it, okay, you can't stand there for 3 seconds. Just like, it's one of the most potent spaces on the court. Like, you have to earn your time there. Like, you can't just camp out there.
I thought that was such an interesting idea, and I just sat there thinking, okay, so, okay, I'm PJ Tucker. I get there. Okay, the ball doesn't get to me. Now I have to do something. What do I do? And I just kept thinking of the Warriors because everyone laughs at Kumbaya Kerr because he wants to have the ball fly all around the court and like guys are throwing all these interior passes and Sean Livingston is randomly cutting over here and Andre Iguodala is randomly screening over there and then when it works it looks pretty and what doesn't work you're like, will you just give the ball to Kevin Durant please? I think it would look a lot like that. Yeah. You'd have like all these high IQ guys throwing little interior passes. It would be kind of, but that was a cool thing. That was cool.
Well, Kiki Vandeweghe had sort of lamented the idea that a lot of these offenses now have like two stationary rooks, like chess piece rooks in the corner of the chessboard all the time. And so I took that and I was like, yeah, how would we get rid of that? Well, one idea is to simply get rid of the corner three, which we wrote about on ESPN. There's an excerpt from the book on there today where we talk about that. But yeah, the other idea is like, have a taste of the big man's medicine. Like, you can't stand there all day, dude.
I like it.
All right.
I want to play in this league. I want this league to exist somewhere in the world, and I would watch
it. We'll get it done.
Well, there's so much more in the book. We barely have scratched the proverbial surface. Kurt Goldsberry, I've known you a long time. It's a pleasure to see you. It's a pleasure to read this book, Sprawl Ball, available today. I think today is day one.
Go buy it, please.
Buy the book. And you can buy it anywhere you buy books, I guess. It looks beautiful. It reads beautiful, Mr. Goldsberry. We will look forward to reading you on ESPN.com. The excerpt is there now. What else? Anything else we should look for?
No, just that.
Just a book. Just buy the book, and you'll
be
on Kimmel. You'll be on Kimmel tonight.
Oh yeah,
Kurt Goldsberry, everybody.
Thank you, Zach.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.